My brother was dead. He had been pitched from his horse and killed on the spot by a concussion of the brain. His death duplicated my mother's. These knocks to the head, oh, how significant they were. My own cranium was a phrenologist's dream. I had been blind, and a stumbling, sprawling impact had given me sight. Of the eyes you can see, and the other one, the third eye. I visited my brother, laid out in his room, where my father was seated beside him with a look of rigid despair. Since I gained the power both to read minds and see into the future, I had avoided the man, because his antipathy toward me was so oppressive. I now felt we blended together as never before.
The Lifted Veil by Jonathan Holloway. Adapted in two parts from the novella by George Eliot. Part 2.
My father was a successful man of money. He had experienced little suffering. The death of his first wife was the heaviest trouble that had befallen him. He married my mother soon after, and to my mind was no different 1 week after her death than he had been before it. Now, at last, a real sorrow had come. The sorrow of old age, crushed pride and hopes. Mr. Fillmore called earlier today.
What for?
He called to tell you the meadow near the church is for sale. He said you told him to keep an eye open for anything adjoining our property.
Yes, I did.
Will you return the visit tomorrow?
No, I think not.
Why?
There doesn't seem to be much point.
The value of our farm might be greatly increased. That field is a parcel of land upon which houses might be built. It is certain that Stiles intends extending his business to include bleaching trenches. He will need houses for the workers. There. Again that awful thrumming sound that meant invasion. Another's mind pushing in to fill up my head.
What's the matter with you, Latimer? Why are you rubbing your temples like that?
A headache, Father. And please don't bark at me. We were talking about money.
Don't speak of business, Latimer. It doesn't suit. I was building the farm for Alfred, my real son. Why keep buying land? It's a dreary thing to live on, doing the same things year after year without knowing why we do them.
Why do you hate me so much?
What?
I am not Alfred. I am not born of your first wife. These are things about which I can do nothing. Why hate me for that which I cannot mend?
But I don't hate you, Latimer.
You don't usually notice me when I enter a room. You are too preoccupied. When you see I'm there, you flinch with disappointment because it's me.
Well, I'm sorry if I give that impression.
Father, I know what is in your head. Because it is written on your face and in your sighs. And because you have not made a penny at business these past 3 months.
What plans do you have?
Should you like me to take over the farm or at the bank?
Certainly, if that is your hope.
No, Father. We aren't being honest. You know I have no ambition that way. I had hoped to become a poet.
Ah.
Yes. It's my mother's influence.
Well, you seem suited to poetry, at least as far as I can make out.
That's not good enough, Father. One needs a passionate optimism for that calling, and a rare talent. I lack both.
There you go again. You know, most of the time I really find it almost impossible to understand what you're talking about. Anyhow, you will not lack for funds, and that means you may seek some pastime of value to the wider world.
I hope, Father, that Alfred's death may have made vacant a more favored place for the less attractive child. Will you not speak to me?
Of course. Why shouldn't I?
You've been very quiet all day, and I cannot tell what's going on inside your head.
Can you read the minds of others, then? I have always suspected you have a secret. That's it, isn't it?
If you mean I have some sensitivity to man's feeling, that I can read faces, that I understand suffering, frustration, then yes, I can read minds. But I cannot read love in you, Bertha.
Because it's not there, Latimer. Your brother is dead, and no one can take his place, at least for some while.
Before his death, you led me to believe there was some feeling between us. Surely, now that Alfred has gone, cannot a space in your heart be opened for me? Will you come to love me, Bertha?
Look into my eyes, Latimer. Don't avert your gaze. Be still. Hold your breath. Look into my eyes. What do you see?
Myself.
And is it the image of a young man who deserves to be loved? Do you see speed, life, good humor? If you do, then perhaps your wish will be granted. It seems it's up to you, doesn't it?
So, now we're away from the bank and its gossip, you can tell me the truth.
What do you mean?
When you've come to town to see me. It's an exceptional occurrence. What's gone wrong?
Nothing is amiss. I know you were relieved to be away from the house, and both it and myself are undivided in your mind. Oh, we are a very awkward family, aren't we?
Yes, Latimer. We are a skewed pair indeed. It seems to me I may have been too hard on you. Is there enough room for us to make amends? Where are we off to, do you think?
Where?
It feels as if I'm in a small boat, in a fast stream, and not only have I lost the oars, but I don't care. I've sunk back onto the cushions, caring not what spinning and buffeting the waters may inflict.
Then come back to the house. Let us make a new friendship.
It's pleasant to hear the kindness in you. I'm sorry you've had nothing of the same from me for a long time. Perhaps a friendship is possible, Latimer. Have you seen anything of Bertha?
Almost daily. We are firm friends, I think.
What do you mean by I think? I mean, surely you are either friends or you're not. Unless there is some complication. Forgive me, Latimer, but is there something between the two of you?
Something, yes. But as yet, it is unformed.
Ah, I see what's coming.
Father, I intend to pursue her for my bride.
Now, she is beautiful. Even I had thoughts. Not very pleasant, wouldn't you say? Do you know if she has feelings for you?
I have hopes. But he remains too full of Alfred yet to consider a second best.
Well, things do move along. I have no idea. In any event, if it did work out, then it would be very nice to have a family atmosphere in the house once again. A marriage could bring a new life to us.
There you go again, looking at me in that hangdog way. Latimer, you must understand that pursuit is deeply unattractive. Disdain, now that has a wholly different effect.
Dishonesty and preening self-regard are not in my nature. I'm sorry about that, Bertha.
And so I'm a shallow thing. Is that the inference? Don't worry, Latimer. I quite agree. I am what I am. Vain and ambitious. Mind you, if you were to smarten yourself and find again that haughty Roman pride so evident when we first met, then I could feel an attraction, to be sure. What are you doing?
I'm making a hashish cigarette. Please pass me the bottle of gum. Can't let go of it now.
Are you going to smoke it?
I've been smoking hashish for some months. I was introduced to it by a friend while I was studying in Geneva. I find in it medicinal and relieving properties.
Might I also find it a relief?
What, to smoke it?
Really? You shouldn't look so shocked. I sometimes think you are far more ordinary than your philosophical leanings allow you to admit.
Very well. Don't blame me if you feel sick.
We sat back into the cushions and smoked the drug. The crackle of electricity between us softened to a warm good humor inconceivable only 30 minutes earlier. She looked at me, and a new miracle came. For the first time, her mind was fully open to me.
Oh, hell! This playful badinage and air of superiority really is such an effort to keep up. But it is essential if I am to carry on intoxicating you, Latimer. Heavens, you really are very close, aren't you? You've not got Alfred's frame, and certainly not his promise. But this close and in this light... Oh, yes. It is said, and I think it true, that life finds its level. A provincial clerk may cut the dash of a London hussar within the limited vista of a county town. And a pale flower like you acquires the sheen of nobility in the damp of Hampshire.
Will you kiss me, Bertha?
Yes.
Will you marry me, Bertha?
Why not? But really, Latimer, you must not have any illusions about what is happening here. Life has more to offer than can be added up in you.
But none of that cruelty mattered to me. I would have traded my soul to the devil for Bertha's body. One night of love was to me worth a continent. Our sweet illusions are half of them conscious self-delusion, like the effects of theatrical color which we know to be made up of tinsel, broken glass, and rags. We were married 18 months after Alfred's death, one cold, clear morning in April, and there came hail and sunshine both together. Some months later, the seasons had turned and I was on the estate when I received an urgent request to attend my father's side.
Perry, where is he? Where is my father?
He's upstairs, sir. The doctor's still here. He said he did not want to leave till you'd arrived.
How did it happen?
He was finishing dinner. I stood by over there waiting to clear. Why, he just popped a piece of cheese into his mouth and then froze up. He sat and stared, with his head half down, looking at a place about 6 inches in front of his plate. And the cheese juice dribbled down his chin and dripped onto the plate. Then he made a sound, like a bubbling in his throat, like drowning. And his face sagged, as if someone had released a string.
Father. Oh, Father.
I am so very sorry, Latimer.
He was almost happy again, Doctor.
I know. These things always seem inopportune.
How is he?
He will survive, but it is a severe stroke, without a doubt.
Should we talk outside?
Oh, it doesn't matter. I doubt he can hear us.
I held my breath and stared into the grey, drooping face. I wanted my talent more than ever to reach into him. And who knows, perhaps to bridge the divide and actually talk to him. That interior was a most frightening place.
Alfred, Alfred, my first boy. The barren, barren land, blind. The waste, narrow. The skull, falling. The skull, no money, none. Poor, loss.
Nothing but fragments. Childish cries jostled with lovemaking and with the carnage of childbirth as my father's lifetime of memory tumbled over and over without shape or sense. His talk of a boat adrift in wild waters had come true.
Will he recover?
He will live on for a time. In my experience, there is little possibility that he will recover.
Can he hear us? Father, can you hear?
It is difficult to tell. I read a recent article by a doctor called Mernier. He claims to have drawn a response from catatonics, but there's nothing certain.
Mernier? Are you sure of that name?
Yes, I remembered it because my brandy carries the same name.
Where does he practice, this Mernier?
Well, naturally, you are entitled to take a second opinion. Indeed, you may throw your funds at as many opinions as you choose. However, I cannot continue with my patient if asked to play second fiddle to one of these youthful physicians who insist on fame through the medium of print.
Dr. Black, my father and I have complete confidence in you. No, it is simply that I suspect this Meunier to be a friend whom I had thought lost to me.
A tragedy? Yes, of course it was. But he was saved from the horror of what was to become of Bertha and I. He believed Bertha to be practical and worldly, and that she would be mistress of me to beneficial effect. The last he saw of me was a 21-year-old madly in love. And that was the best time to exit the play.
I think he's trying to speak to us.
No, Latimer. It is nothing but an involuntary spasm. He cannot hear us.
Meunier, my old friend Charles. I was reminded of him only briefly, and once again lost in Bertha, I neglected to track him down. My wife's gloss and show and society celebrations were constantly marred by a meanness of spirit, a brattish, spoilt manner which made light of the rest of the world and its struggles. Her mind remained peculiarly opaque to my supernatural abilities, except when, as with the hashish incident, she was intoxicated with drink. Then the full extent of her flirtatious hedonism became transparent.
That'll be all, Fletcher.
Very well, ma'am. Bertha, may I speak to you?
There you go again. Don't address me in the manner of an irritable cashier, please.
I don't want the servants to hear. Please step into the room.
What have I done wrong?
Last night at dinner, you paid a great deal of attention to the curate.
He looked lonely. He's a young fellow, and it cannot give him much joy to spend the days with spluttering labourers. I wanted him to feel more part of things.
And when we were alone later, you were very vigorous.
You make me blush, Latimer. Heavens, I see. Well now, if I read you right, Latimer, the question on your lips is one best neither asked nor answered. So, some Middle Eastern taste at which I have never guessed. Well, well. Perhaps it would have been better for your part if I had offered the fellow our hospitality overnight.
Please, Bertha.
Oh, Latimer, don't look so sour-faced. I am your wife. You should share your secrets.
I hated the vulgar display she made. And yet... She looked so beautiful, and I was allowed her nakedness, and in that intoxication all anxiety slipped away. The Faustian pact held. I was addicted to the pornography of her. All was forgiven at night. Bertha. Bertha.
Latimer. Oh, I am very tired. Please go back to your room.
Bertha, please, I don't want to go away.
Really, Latimer, it's just such bad taste to press the matter like this. Please, please go back to your room. We'll talk tomorrow.
What are we to make of it, Bertha?
Make of it, Latimer. What on earth do you mean, make of it?
I cannot continue like this indefinitely. It is my intention to make my mark in the sphere of literature. This constant visiting and partying may have been appropriate at the start, but I need to get on with my work. I have things to say, Bertha.
So, I don't want you in my bed, and now you're making an argument. How very reasonable. Now then, what are these things you have to say? What may they be? What gift of insight do you have to offer to humanity?
Our life together is not what I had hoped for, Bertha.
Nor are you. What I hope for. But we must all cut our cloth, eh? Oh, you have been blessed, Latimer, with the extreme good luck of having a near fortune settled upon you while you are still young enough to enjoy it. So enjoy it, then. And just stop pretending you are better than the rest of us. Now, to show I'm not entirely evil, we shall have a quiet time next week. Besides, There's no one in the county at present who is of much concern. At least not till Friday. Please return to your room. Green does suit me, it's true. That's one of my talents, I suppose. It's a difficult colour and it does not suit many ladies.
It's really good to have some quiet time together. I feel things have taken an excellent turn this week. The country looks beautiful. We've had time to enjoy both it and each other.
How much longer will you want to stay out?
Oh, I don't know. I thought we might take a turn down by the lake, then walk up past the church on our way home. Then this afternoon, I hoped you might read to Father.
What time is it?
Nearly 12 o'clock.
Ah. I ought to get back to the house quite soon.
Why?
Because we have guests arriving for luncheon.
I had no idea we were expecting visitors. Oh, really, Bertha, I thought we were just beginning to enjoy each other properly. Why have you invited people? Can't we be together?
It's boring, Latimer. You are boring. The countryside is boring.
I can see Perry coming. Please be quiet, Bertha. Perry, what's the matter?
Sir, I think you should return to the house.
Are the guests here?
No, madam. Sir, your father, sir.
Oh, no.
What's the matter with him?
I think you should come indoors, sir. I fear he has taken a turn for the worse.
Father!
I have said that Bertha's interior was hitherto closed off to my mind-reading. But the incident of my father's death acted as some catalyst to extend the gift. And at last, Bertha's soul was fully on show. Perhaps it was the first day on which passion was completely neutralized by the presence of a far stronger emotion. I had been watching by my father's deathbed. I had seen the last fitful yearning for life in his eyes. I had felt the final statement of love in the pressure from his hand. In that moment of earthquake, all other concerns are diminished.
It's a shame, Latimer, but we must make sure his funeral is remembered. I will look glorious in black. The horses will wear 8-foot plumes. People will look and see my heroism, and the world will say she really is pitiable to have such a husband, such a graceful, brilliant woman. That wild poet's passion of yours, Latimer, it's nothing more than an expression of your uselessness. You will be my slave, and I, a rich young wife, will be excused whatever scandal by virtue of being stranded with a crack brain. Why are you staring like that? Stay where you are. Don't come any closer. What on earth is wrong with you?
At last I can see you for what you are. The veil of illusion has lifted. I can see into you and through you. In this moment, things are turned about, Bertha.
Stay there!
Until now, I was able to forgive you anything. I was able to pretend your greater abilities. In my mind, you were a labyrinth of contradictions, an intelligence who saw a greater panorama than the rest of us, and whose small prejudices were an enticing fragment of a bigger, richer personality. Now I can see all over the narrow room of your soul, Bertha. You're as much as you speak and nothing more. Ill-informed, scarcely literate, a girl who defines herself by systematic coquetry and selfishness.
Well, what a fine speech!
Oppositions are reversed, Bertha. You'll live according to that or you'll leave here without a penny. I have trembled before your unknown soul, which turned out to be a fiction of my own making. Now I have torn up the story and thrown it on the grate.
I can pull you down, Latimer. People don't like you. You make them uncomfortable with your mincing and your pretensions.
You're an orphan, Bertha, and the law sits with me. There will be no quarrels between us, and our repulsion will lie in silence.
People already pity me.
That's of no matter, because your acquaintances are of the most shallow variety. Let us just keep our distance, Bertha.
After this, I interfered so little with Bertha's habits. It seems wonderful how her hatred toward me could grow so intense and active as it did. But she was now alerted to the possibility of my gift. She was increasingly haunted by a terror of me, of my power of penetration. She had despised me as an imbecile. Now she dreaded me as an interrogator. Years passed. So much misery. So slow and hideous a growth of hatred and sin. 7 years of dread and vain wrestling.
You madman! You idiot! Why don't you hurry up and kill yourself?
It was the apparition. That picture of hatred, the premonition from the terrace in Vienna. And now, I understood its truth.
I've had to hire a new housekeeper called Archer. Fletcher's going to be married, and she wants me to ask you to let her husband have the public house in Farmed Moulton.
What about Perry? He usually hires staff.
I am taking more of a hand in the house. Surely you're pleased about that, aren't you? More wifely. Anyway, Perry will be absent from us for a while. His wife is very ill, and she must return to her family. He's taking you to accompany her. Look, I wish Fletcher's intended to have the public house. You must give the promise now, because Fletcher's going tomorrow morning. And quickly, because I'm in a hurry.
Very well. You may promise her.
I shrank from meeting this new maid. Mrs. Archer, if she was to be Bertha's choice, must be a malevolent creature out of the same pattern. Indeed, when we did meet, her appearance confirmed my fears. But oh, how wrong I was. Too late it was that I discovered the virtue in the woman.
So, I would appreciate it, Archer, if you would bring refreshments and so on only when I call for them.
Well, I am sorry to have disturbed you, sir, in my previous position. There were set times for tea and so on. I was doing what I thought would be expected of me.
Yes, I see that, but it's different here. You see, I have my work and it just won't do to be interrupted. Muse and all that.
I see, sir.
That accent. Where are you from?
My family came from Bristol, originally.
Ah. A long way.
Yes, it is.
That will be all. No, wait. Bertha, have you a moment?
It is true that Mrs. Archer disliked me. However, it is difficult to unpick the circumstance of that attitude. Certainly, looking back, I did nothing to befriend the woman, and everything to support Bertha's eccentric and poisoned portrait of me.
Bertha, is Mrs. Archer available to go to town this afternoon?
Why?
I need another notebook and ink.
Oh, certainly, she can get the things for you. Although it will take her away from other duties, they can wait.
But, madam, I thought you wanted me to travel to town.
What made you think that?
I'm sorry, madam. I thought you spoke to me after breakfast.
What are you up to, Archer?
Is there something here which is passing me by?
All right, Latimer. There's no need to look like that. Yes, I had already determined that Archer is to go on an errand for me.
What for, and why should it be so secret?
Really, Latimer, there are some things to do with womanhood which I would rather not go over. Archer is visiting the apothecary for me.
I understand. Well, at least it won't be an inconvenience for you to visit the stationery shop as well, Archer.
After 8 or 9 months had passed, I became aware of a profound change in Bertha's attitude to Mrs. Archer. An odd, complicated thing had taken place in their relationship. Bertha had power over the older woman, but came to regard her servant with a mingled feeling of fear and dependence, as though they shared some secret. Archer's visits to the apothecary seemed unusually frequent, but I made no further remarks on the subject. There was enough tension in the house without adding to it. I have no idea how it was the pair were able to deny me access to the thoughts which would have betrayed their plotting. It now seems obvious. Bertha was fully aware of my clairvoyance and had trained both Archer and herself effectively to edit their thoughts. Only once did the barrier slip. One evening, I was passing my wife's bedroom door and was stopped by an awareness of the two women's excited anxiety. There was glee mixed with dread and an extraordinary anticipation. I stopped and gently pushed the door open. A strange, candlelit tableau was revealed. The two were bent over Bertha's cabinet. A drawer had just been closed, and their eyes remained fixed upon it as Bertha turned the key.
Latimer, how long have you been there?
I felt the shared effort to forget that which had so occupied them a moment before.
A woman must have her secrets, Latimer, and it is unfair of you to peer into them.
The terrible disappointment of Bertha cramped my joy in creating, and my writing dried to a trickle. The insight which had made humanity transparent became dulled, and the gift of mind-reading dried up. I was soon relieved of the cacophony of other interiors. Only the unpredictable premonitions continued. I lived in a twilight world of strange skies, sandy plains, gigantic ruins, midnight skies of unrecognizable constellations.
I used to think you were a clairvoyant, and that was the reason you scoffed at others and thought yourself special. I see now you have become rather duller than the rest of the world.
Unloving and unloved, there is no religion possible. No worship, Bertha, but the worship of devils. And now came the worst of all visions. That of my own death. Time and time again, continually recurring.
I don't want to die. You see, I'm not ready. No one is ever ready. Hold my hand, please.
Sir, hadn't I better run for the doctor?
No, I don't want to die on my own. You've got to stay, please.
You're not going to die, sir.
Yes, I am. I have known the date and time of my death for as long as I can remember. I have died in a dream countless times. I even know that as the life drains out of me, the last thing I will see is the small caster on the leg of the card table.
Oh, Mr. Latimer. You have not appeared in the best of health these past days. The weather seems unusually clement today, Latimer. Would you like to take the carriage out this afternoon?
No, thank you, Bertha. I don't feel up to it. I had to stop halfway on the stairs earlier. Shortness of breath and an unaccustomed ache in my chest.
I think you ought to call Dr. Black.
No, Bertha, I'm sure it will pass.
But if you have some inflammation of the heart, then you should be treated.
I had no idea you took an interest in such things. An inflammation of the heart, eh?
I have many interests of which you know nothing, Latimer. Well, then, a turn in the sun might be a sufficient tonic.
Come.
There's a letter for you, sir.
Thank you, Archer. Ah. This is excellent news, really.
Who is it from?
My old friend Charles Mernier. He's been working in Edinburgh and is coming south again for a rest.
What does he say?
A joke we had about Edinburgh. Slums and drizzle. Charles is a very sympathetic nature. It will be wonderful to see him again.
So he will visit us, then?
Oh, not just a visit. I intend to persuade him to stay for a good while.
Are you sure, Latimer? I mean, if you're not well...
Since I'm not in the best of health, who better to have as a guest than a physician with a European reputation? Bertha, we have become too fixed upon the disappointment of one another. On reflection, it seems obvious that a union born out of the death of another must become difficult. We should have been wiser. This hard effort has worn us down. It may be that Charles's presence will prompt some resurrection into a happier pre-existence.
For you, perhaps, Latimer. But for me, I'm afraid it is likely to be something of a setback. I had thought we were getting on so much better. I had thought to have you to myself in the coming weeks, to do with as I saw fit.
A month or so elapsed before Charles arrived. In the meantime, there took place a very odd incident between Archer and my wife. The two women had been on a visit some miles away and had quarreled. On returning to our house, I heard them arguing downstairs with voices raised.
I'm not sure I can continue with this. You don't have a choice. You agreed. We both agreed. You are as committed as I.
I don't have to do anything. It's hardly a conventional duty as far as household affairs are concerned, is it?
Archer! We have already been over this. Your situation is more than generous. Generous? Go about your business.
Archer's tone of bitter insolence should have been a reason for immediate dismissal.
Bertha, what on earth's the matter?
Latimer, I didn't know you were there. What are you doing?
I was in my room. I heard voices. I came out on the landing to see what's going on.
Oh, really, it's nothing. I had to tell Archer off about something.
It sounded as if she was telling you off as well. Don't you think we ought to get rid of her?
No, Latimer. I don't think that would be appropriate. Thinking about it, I was probably in the wrong.
Even so.
I run the house, Latimer. Leave it to me, please. I will deal with things.
Sir, what's she saying to you, sir? About me?
I beg your pardon, Archer?
There's no need for this, Archer. Everything is satisfactory. We'll just carry on as we were.
Perhaps I should be having a little word with you too, sir.
I won't put up with this. What in God's name is happening here?
It's all right, Archer. We've had our talk and everything is well. Latimer, I absolutely do not want to take this any further. Archer, please go back to the kitchen. We will carry on just as before.
Yes, madam. Just as before.
Shortly after this disturbing incident, Archer suffered a desperate bout of food poisoning. Bertha was far more solicitous to the woman than I thought she deserved. She was at Archer's bedside night and day and would allow no one else to officiate as head nurse. The bile, or some such, caused terrible ulceration of Archer's throat. She could barely move, and all communication was denied her. The only time I visited her sick room, the woman's eyes followed me about the chamber with such an unblinking intensity that I didn't venture back in there again. The illness and Dr. Black's temporary absence from the neighborhood made Charles Meunier's arrival doubly welcome.
It's a poor exchange, I'm afraid, Charles. Gone are the snow-capped mountains and the clear blue lakes of Switzerland. Geneva seems another lifetime. A meadow, a copse, and bluebells are the best we can offer in Hampshire.
Oh, don't do it down, Latimer. I'm very pleased to be here. I feel thoroughly wrung out after the last few years. Certainly my posterior has had enough of being bashed about the terrible highways of Europe. Oh, it's good to be somewhere moderate.
Moderate, eh? Well, I'm not sure how good we are at moderation around here. Extremity seems more our forte. But there's plenty of time for all that. Now, come on. What is this special thing that's winning you such a name?
Don't really want to know all that, do you?
Yes, yes, really. I feel too much on the margins these days. Please, Charles.
All right. The power of the human will. The theory of it runs like this. The brain is an organ connected to all the other organs. The brain is also the home of the mind and the soul. If the mind is sick, it is logical this must affect the organ which houses it. Surely it is self-evident there is a direct relationship between the activity of the brain and the health of the body. Yet physicians give no time at all to it. A sad man stops eating properly, avoids the company of others, retires from the light, gets ill. A happy man is out and about, eats beef, drinks ale, laughs, and lives until 80. I suppose there's money to be made in potions, but precious little to be costed out in the business of happiness, and medicine is, after all, a business. The money is made by treating illness, not making people well.
It seems a simple thing. But how does it make you a fortune?
An Italian nobleman feels the years weighing upon him. His glory days of womanizing and hunting are far behind. He hurts his leg and takes to his bed. Depression keeps him there. He's got poor circulation, it's a bad winter, he stays in bed too long, and the leg goes ulcerous. Now I get him up, walk him about, get him back on a horse, what have you. The circulation improves and he feels resurrected. Yeah, all right, I'm being flippant. But I do have to earn a living.
And I hear society embraces you very willingly.
Oh, you know, noble women without a brain in their heads sit looking fascinated, pretending to listen. Their noble husbands boast of my acquaintance, themselves ambitious to be taken for having brains.
And how far can all this go? You spoke of some very extraordinary things in the past.
Just like old times, eh? Well, if you've the stomach for it, Latimer.
Go ahead, please, Charles.
All right. We know nothing of our limits until we try them. What if the will can not only cure afflictions but stave off death? And when does the mind desert the body? Could we bring the skills of science together with the human will and snatch a man back from behind the veil? Can death be vanquished, do you think, Latimer?
You're leaping ahead in a way that makes me breathless. Can we stop a moment?
You're right. It's a little soon to be discussing such things in earnest.
No, I mean stop walking. I'm feeling breathless, and this damn pain in my chest has come back.
Oh, sorry. Yes, let's sit over here. Latimer, as an old friend, you'll forgive me if I say the years aren't treating you too well. You look worn down, old fellow.
I'll get my breath back in a moment.
I spent a short time on the Ruhr, writing a paper on chemical poisoning, alloy workers. It's funny, but you've got something of the same look about you. A pallor, I noticed, in those mixing the oxide additives.
I assure you, Mernier, I am the last human being on Earth likely to suffer the effects of industrial process.
Yes, I'm sure you're right. Supper last night. Bit of a queer atmosphere, if you don't mind me saying.
You're not to care too much about my wife's behavior. I know it's something of an embarrassment. She expected you to be as dull as she finds me, now presented with an eminent physician and a desirable bachelor. She cannot help but put forth all her coquetries and accomplishments.
The old adage about familiarity and contempt has a truth here. You and she had flirted too far before Alfred's death made the way clear. By the time you could marry, the energy of life had already gone from it. How long have you felt ill?
Oh, weeks. There are days I don't get out of bed. Do you think I could do with some of that Italian fellow's prescriptions?
Ah, yes, perhaps. But the thing is, the treatment is not complete unless one takes away the source of the illness. You would have to face up to that if you want to be entirely well.
You mean Bertha? You've gone quiet.
Perhaps we've taken everything too quickly. We need to get to know each other again. Let's return to the house, and I'll take another look at that housekeeper of yours. Hmm?
You're very quiet, Charles. Is it a peculiar case in some way? The woman seems very ill.
No, it's not peculiar, but it's not absolutely certain either. There are some inconsistencies, you see. I think it's an attack of peritonitis which will be fatal. I don't understand what's wrong with the poor woman's throat, though. But I'll tell you what I have in my mind. I want to make an experiment on this woman, if you will give me permission. It can do her no harm, will give her no pain, for I shall not make it until life is extinct. I want to try the effect of transfusing blood into her arteries after the heart has ceased to beat for some minutes. I've tried the experiment again and again with animals with astounding results. I want to try it on a human subject. I have the tubes amongst my materials, and I can easily make up the rest of the equipment. I will use my own blood from my arm.
Your suggestion is...
What? Too daring. Latimer, this woman won't live through the night, and I will need your assistance with the experiment. Why, I can't call another doctor in. A disagreeable, foolish version of the thing might get abroad.
Have you spoken to my wife on the subject?
Why, after all the things which have transpired between you two, would you ask me to give credence to her opinion?
It's just that she appears peculiarly sensitive about this woman.
To tell you the truth, I don't want her to know about it. Women are a problem in anything medical, and the effect on the supposed dead body may be startling. Now, you and I will sit up together. When death is imminent, I shall take you in. When the moment comes, we must get everyone out of the room. There will be no marvelous recovery. The best we can hope for is a temporary reanimation. I will mark a series of puncture points. You will insert tubes to drain off the poisoned blood. Meanwhile, I will drive a tube straight into the heart and, by pumping my arm, inject my own blood into her.
Please, Bertha.
What? Oh, Charles. I'm sorry.
You should go to bed now. I will sit up with her. She's very ill, and sleeping is the best thing for her. I doubt she'll wake again tonight. If she does, then I will be here.
No, Charles. She's my maid, and I must look after her. We were really quite close, and I think she'll be afraid if she wakes and I've gone away.
You are taking on too much, Bertha. Your husband is not in the best of health. He needs you well.
But supposing she died and I wasn't here, I would never forgive myself.
You must listen to me, Bertha. I insist you return to your room. I will watch over her. Now, please do as I say.
All right. But you are to wake me if there is any flicker of consciousness. Promise me.
I promise.
Good night, then.
Latimer!
We must wait now. Can you think of any reason why this woman should feel a grievance against your wife?
There was some misunderstanding between them before her illness. What it was?
Because I observed, before she drifted into coma, there was a huge desire in her to say something which pain and weakness prevented her from uttering. There was a look of hideous meaning in her eyes, which she kept fixed upon her mistress. In this disease, the mind remains pretty much clear until the last moment.
I'm not surprised at her malevolence. I have always distrusted and disliked her.
It's nearly time. That quickening of breath is involuntary and inevitably precedes death. Prepare the things. Now, she's going. Come on, we must get to it.
For the next 20 minutes, I forgot everything but Meunier and the experiment in which he was so absorbed. As soon as the transfusion was effected, the drain tubes were tied off. I then had to keep up the artificial respiration of the body. Meunier soon relieved me and worked harder to press air into the body's system. And then, the miracle began. The breast heaved by itself, and the respirations grew stronger. The eyelids quivered as the soul returned beneath them. There was a movement of the lips.
Latimer! Charles, what is he doing here? What's happening? What have you done? Did she speak?
The dead woman's eyes were wide open. She was sitting upright, covered in the gore of our efforts. Bertha and she fixed their gaze upon one another, and the dead woman's pointed finger was leveled against my wife.
Murderer. You intended to poison your husband, as you did me. The poison is in the black cabinet. I got it for you, little by little. You told lies about me behind my back to make me disgusting so that I would be blamed. Damn you! Are you sorry now?
The wretched woman's heartstrings had been set to hatred and vengeance. The spirit of life swept the cords for an instant and was gone forever. Bertha stood pale at the foot of the bed, quivering, helpless and bereft of guile and devices.
I think perhaps we should clear away. What has happened here will change our lives, and there must be no evidence left. You are a devil, Bertha. You are damned and deserve no pity. But you cannot use this against your wife, Latimer. There is no law on earth that would believe the truth of all this. But take heart. I think that in time Bertha will meet her punishment.
We'll rest, eh? Would you like a drink?
Yes, please.
Of course,
I had the wrong end of things all the time.
Will.
Sheer intensity of human will. I was looking in the wrong place. It's not a question of bringing people back from the other side. The real act of will is to defy death from this side. To refuse to give in. That's what you've taught me. In time, there will be long life because people will refuse to die.
You credit me too much, Charles. I cannot hold death back. Simply, I know when it will come.
To know that a marriage will go sour. To embrace it, nevertheless. That is the strange cartwheel we lash ourselves to. Odder even than knowing we will die. To tie oneself to a poisoned life. Desire and lust. God's given drug. The force that propels us forward under the shadow of thwarted desire. Cosmic loneliness and death. Imagine how much more humankind would achieve if that lowering cloud of mortality could be held back. Ah, what a glittering victory. How much more grace than is offered by God's gift of squalid sexual desire.
Now I see it all. The veil has fallen, and it is a clear path to oblivion. There is no reason to struggle. I want ordinary concourse with these sturdy alpine folk, for example. But that is not possible, because I see their ends as clearly as my own, and I cannot summon up the energy to speak with dead people, with ambulant shades.
What about me? Latimer, can you see my end?
Oh, yes. But it is not to be talked of. Because it is too cruel for us to consider and remain friends.
Well, come what may, I defy death. I refuse to die until I choose. Come on, let's get to the summit.
No, I cannot manage. I will wait for you here.
Come on, Latimer. At least let's get to the lookout together. It's only 50 yards. You can see the overhang from where I'm standing.
No, that's it, I'm afraid. I'm not going to get there, Charles. You go on. I'll rest here and be ready to go back when you've had a good look at the view.
It's ridiculous to stop. You're practically there. It might be uncomfortable, but you know it can't kill you. To be so close and not to see the view, it doesn't make sense.
I've scaled my heights and found what little there was of worth. There are no great sights I feel the want of now.
Do not allow that witch to ruin your life, Latimer.
What remains of it?
For the time that is left. You are a phenomenon, Latimer. A unique creature. It's everything that's most fantastical. A man who cannot die until the moment he decides to. It is a wonderful dream. I need to see you push yourself, Latimer. I need to see you at the limit of endurance.
I am at that limit now, Charles. Leave me here. Let me rest.
All right. I will be back within an hour.
I will see you later, Charles. Later on.
I think perhaps you should send to your wife.
For comfort and all that sort of thing. No, Dr. Black, there will be no deathbed reconciliation. Bertha and I are happier apart.
Why don't you let me send?
She is mistress of half our wealth and lives in a neighborhood quite far away.
There is no reason to feel you are any closer to death now than at any time in the last year. Now, this morbidity is not healthy. And that devilish drug.
That's Charles's influence. I travelled to Europe with Charles once we parted company. He to the courts of princes. Myself to wander those beloved Alps. But then the cursed mind reading came back and spoilt it. And now I have come home to die.
That's enough, Latimer. I will come back later. On my way to church.
I am told Bertha lives pitied and admired.
I hear they are bemused at what I should have against such a charming woman. Her poison plot is in part successful. Her chemicals have broken my health and given me what you, Dr. Black, in your naivety describe as angina. And now I know why Lucrezia Borgia came to life in my presence, and that I was in love with a woman in her likeness. And now, on the 20th of September, 1850, I look down at these words as if they are old friends. I have seen them in my mind's eye a thousand times, and beheld this, the scene of my dying struggle.
Perry! Perry! Help me! Quickly, Perry!
Oh, sir. Oh, Mr. Latimer.
I don't want to die. You see, I'm not ready. No one is ever ready. Hold my hand, please.
The part of Latimer was played by Toby Stevens. Father, Tim Piggott Smith. Bertha, Abigail Doherty. Charles Meunier, Ian Hughes. Dr. Black, John Rowe. And Mrs. Archer, Carolyn Jones. With Tracy Ann Oberman and Christopher Wright. Technical presentation by Richard Beedsmore, Rosamond Mason and Rebecca Kirby. Production assistant, Sarah Tombling. The Lifted Veil by Jonathan Holloway, based on George Eliot's novella, was directed by Jane Morgan.